is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 153, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. This week, I'm talking to Bill Weber about his book, UFO Sightings, Reports and Cover-Ups. Bill was the former Mutual UFO Network State Director for the state of Delaware and for a short time, the state of Pennsylvania. As the state director, he was responsible for a team of state section directors, chief investigators, and certified field investigators within these states, and Bill was also a member of the MUFON Star Team. During his 26 years with MUFON, he investigated over 100 cases and has presented research at the MUFON 2011, 2013, and 2017 PA State Conferences. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 140 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the podcast. So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called UFO Sightings, Reports and Cover-Ups. So you were with MUFON for 26 years. Can you tell us about MUFON?
It's an acronym that stands for the Mutual UFO Network. And MUFON has been in existence since 1969, over 50 years. And they started up essentially after it was alleged that Project Blue was shut down. So they shut it down in 69. MUFON was founded in 69.
Was it a response to Blue Book shutting down, or was it a coincidence that started at the same time?
I think what it was there were a lot of ufologists out there that were somewhat aggravated in the fact that Project Blue Book essentially was put together as a venue to discredit and deny people's reports. And they had an individual there from the scientific community, J. Allen Hynek, whose purpose in life was to deny and put down and discredit the reports coming in. But after a period of time, after himself realizing that there are thousands of reports coming in, that he went out and started his own organization called QFOS, which is the Center for UFO Studies, because he's saying there's got to be something to this stuff. So now he set up his own QFOS organization, which is one that is in exploring this. There's another one out there called the National UFO Reporting Center. It's NUFORC. Now, QFOS and NUFORC are programs that are set up not to deny, but to actually take down reports and maintain databases. Now, MUFON did the same thing. However, they took it a next step where they actually have training. They train field investigators on multiple subjects, and the idea is not only to take the report and put it into their database that contains well over 100,000 reports since 1995, to actually go out, contact the witness or witnesses, and then do a thorough investigation to try to figure out what was actually seen or been reported, and then come up with some type of a disposition. And I would say maybe in about 80-85% of the time, the final disposition is a known object. Okay, it's the other 15-20% that MUFON doesn't know what it was that was seen, and it's recorded as an unknown. So I've been with them over 26 years, starting out as a field investigator, and worked my way up through the ranks, based here in Pennsylvania as a field investigator, and then I was promoted up to a what they call a state section director. Now, what that is in the state of Pennsylvania, we have counties, okay? And Pennsylvania had 67 counties. So what I did is I divided up the state into groups that we call that I called sections, and then field investigators that live in those sections were then responsible for cases that came in. Now, after a period of time being a state section director, I was responsible probably for five or six counties in the local Philadelphia area. I was promoted up to become chief investigator for the whole state, which I then worked together with all of the other state section directors and field investigators. And I guess I was the number two guy, because above me was the state director, who was responsible for programs and so on, as well as support of the organization within the state. And as time went on, then he moved on and they moved me up to state director of Pennsylvania. I also was approached by a MUFON organization and asked if I would take over the state of Delaware, which I had agreed to. So I was carrying two states as the state director. In Delaware, I built up to include a number of different field investigators and such within that organization. And then after a period of time, it became a little bit too much, so I decided to back out of it and essentially spend the time doing my own research and such, and which freed me up to write this book. Now, during my time with MUFON, I had investigated well over 100 cases plus, consisting of anything from orbs and lights in the sky to touchdowns to actual abduction case that I actually have tape on. I taped that whole session. So, these are in my archives and my files. And, I believe this stuff. And I wanted basically to write this book to include various cases that either directly or indirectly I've been involved in, and to get the message out there that we're not alone. This stuff is happening and it's real. And this book goes on to uncover some of the denials and cover-ups that precipitated me writing this to prove to people that here, this is stuff. We actually have radar on this stuff, okay? And it's been denied that we didn't have our radar turned on at that time. We don't see what you're seeing, and so on and so forth. And it's quite concerning, because in one of my chapters, there was a grouping of aircraft that consisted of multiple targets. When I say target, they were metallic targets, but they didn't include a transponder on them. In normal aircraft here in the U.S., they have transponders. I guess it's global. They have transponders so that if they're pinged with radar, this transponder would return back a signal indicating that, hey, I'm here, I'm an aircraft, and this is my and my number and so on, which was used to identify what the aircraft is and so on. So these targets represented an area that was roughly 3 football fields or over 900 feet long and about 150 feet wide. We're traveling above an area called Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Now, there was another target coming up, which had a transponder on it. It was transponder number 4207. And as the report came in, how MUFON works is somebody will see something in the sky, and not knowing what to do, we encourage them to file a report with MUFON. MUFON then will receive the report and go through it to verify it and then enter it into our database. They then will take a look and say, where did this report come from? Did it come, what state? So on. In this case, the state was Pennsylvania. So then they entered it in and then they contacted me and said, we have this in this area. So I took a look at what area it was in, and I contacted the investigator at that area. I also was involved with them, too, due to the nature of the report. And essentially, then the witnesses were contacted, and we took reports from them, which then indicated the size of the objects being seen and the direction they were going and so on and so forth. So then what we did is my investigator, which is normal procedure, contacted the FAA, Federal Administration, and wanted to see what they had, if anything, on their radars. And normally they would not tell us anything, but I think for this particular situation, they had sent us actual radars back. Now, we, MUFON had an individual based in Colorado who was a radar specialist, and when we received the material back from the FAA, it looked like somebody spilled a container of pepper on a white sheet of paper. We didn't understand what we're looking at, so we contacted this individual and sent these that data to him. He then took a look at it and interpreted it, and then actually overlaid it on a grid pattern over the city of Bethlehem. And that whole synopsis is in the book, okay? And you can track the actual object pattern coming and heading into a direction that the aircraft 4207 was flying into, and they came within 1 mile of a mid-air collision where I guess the pilot in the aircraft called down to the tower and says, get me the heck out of here. And he took evasive action and actually put his plane down at Lehigh Valley Airport. Meanwhile, this pattern of multiple objects was still there, and it was heading in a southeasterly direction. So from there, then, my investigator then elected to contact the Willow Grove Naval Base to see if they had anything on their radars. And we wait. Now, within MUFON, from the time that someone files a report until we come up with some type of a disposition, we have a window of 90 days. And typically, we try to contact the witness within 24 hours of receiving the report. So we have that 90-day window that we have to do our investigation and contact multiple witnesses, multiple authorities, the Air Force, the FAA, local and state police departments, and so on, to try to get as much information about the particular sighting as possible. Well, I contacted the airport once we got our radars back, and I said, I'd want to talk to you about the nature of the aircraft that was sending the signal 4207 from its transponder. What type of aircraft was it? Who was the pilot? Can I talk to the pilot? Can I talk to any passengers on that plane that might have seen this grouping? And he said, well, he said, you have to talk to the tower, okay? So I says, all right, put me through to the tower. He says, but in the meantime, he says, send me up what you have, and then we'll go over it. And I says, no. I says, I'll bring it up, and then we can sit down and talk together, but I'm not leaving anything with you. I'm taking it with me. Well, to that end, I never heard anything back from either the airport manager or the tower, and I've tried multiple times, and they just do not call me. Now, my investigator contacted Willow Grove Airport, again, being very specific on the date, the time, and so on, and the location of this grouping, and we received back a response after 3 months that basically says, oh, well, we didn't have our radars turned on that particular day, which is another form of denial. So they just blew us off, okay? And that's very frustrating, and I documented all of that, including the radars for that incident are in that book. You can actually track to see how close they were coming and see the evasive action that the aircraft took to avoid the collision. There are other incidences of where we have radar, where in a busy area, there's a high traffic area between New York and Greater Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. That airspace is very busy. And my radar expert was quite concerned when we sent additional radar tracking to him from an area that was in an area called Mountaintop, Pennsylvania, where a witness spotted something. And what my radar analyst did, he had explored other things at higher altitudes and so on and so forth. And he says that whole area is very, very busy and populated with unknown metallic objects in that area. And he was quite concerned about the amount of traffic, and you know, that could result in another, God forbid, a mid-air collision or some issues with existing aircraft because of the amount of traffic between New York and D.C. going back and forth. And essentially, that hasn't been resolved either, okay? The object that was reported over Mountaintop was picked up on four or five different radar antennas, and it's documented in the book. People have been seeing things for a long, long, long time, unidentified objects and such. I mean, I go back, like in the book, I have a chapter entitled In the Beginning, where there was a historian back in the year, like 343 or something, BC, who reported seeing objects and stuff. And he had, put this in his reports. Okay, there was other reports of, the Roman government had seen things in the year 218 BC where they said, hey, you know, these things are up in the sky. We don't know what they are, but it was in the government records, the Rome government records, of a report they called Gleaming Shields. Okay. Now, moving forward, in the year 1492, where Christopher Columbus was coming over and discovered America, he was being followed by an object, and he brought it to the attention of his crew, and it was recorded in his logbook, okay, of an object that was following his ship, and he was on the Santa Maria, and essentially it took off and went up into the sky. So these things have been around a while over in Nuremberg, Germany. Okay. I think the year was like 1561. There are reports of multiple objects in the sky, almost like they're having a battle up there with explosions and stuff going on. And it was documented in, the Nuremberg Gazette. So, soon after that, there was another report of sightings and such going on in Basel, Switzerland, where similar type things. It looked like there was a war or something going on in the skies out there, and that was that was put down in wood carvings that were that are kept there. Okay, so a lot of this stuff is being seen now. Fast forwarding to the year 1897, okay, there was a report of an object that crashed into a windmill over in a town called Aurora, Texas. And it got people's attention because it created a big explosion and there were pieces of it all over the place. Excuse me. And apparently there was a body that was recovered and it was buried. And they had a headstone on it. Now, years later, in the 2000s, MUFON investigators went out to Aurora to try to figure out and find what was going on. Now, they found material that, looks like it came from a high temperature, high velocity explosion. They found that out there. They were looking for the body and stuff, and what they found was that people didn't want to have the notoriety of and all of these people climbing all over their little town of Aurora. So they actually moved and removed the headstone that they put in place over this alleged pilot that was buried there. So they've never found the pilot. Okay, but that case is on MUFON in our database. So again, the pattern, cover up. If we move forward now to Roswell, there was an aircraft that a UFO crashed out there at Roswell. And there was a farmer there who went out and uncovered some things and contacted the sheriff that then contacted the army. And then the army went out and cordoned off the whole area. There were materials that were uncovered And there were bodies that were uncovered and found. In fact, there were supposedly a living entity out there that then was recovered and taken out to a final resting place was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Okay. Now, of the materials that were uncovered from the wreck, they found these spaghetti-looking strands. They didn't know what they were. They found these, I guess you call them, little substrates that had these objects all over them. They didn't know what they were. And they were taken, these artifacts that were recovered. And they were recovered by a Major Corso, and under the control of Major Corso, who then stored them for a while. And then eventually, like here in the U.S., the best place to hide something is in real sight. So what they did is, rather than put it on, under control of the government, where we may be able to get to access to it under what's called the Freedom of Information Act, where we can file that and hopefully try to get some information, they were given to various industries that they're protected under company trademark. So the spaghetti-looking things were given to a company called Corning. That's a huge glass manufacturing, Corningware, and so on and so forth. The other objects that were uncovered, these little black things, they didn't know what they were. They gave them over to a company called AT&T Bell Laboratories to reverse engineer to try to figure out what they were. These other objects they found, they didn't know what they were, so they gave them over to a company called Texas Instruments. And the material, the metal, this they could bend it, and then it would turn right back to its normal shape. They sent that to another organization called Battelle, located in Ohio. And by the way, all of the organizations that they sent this material to were all under government contracts. So, and if you fast forward now to our technology today, if you think about it, the little brown or the little objects that they discovered in 47 that went to Bell Labs, it's amazing that Bell Labs and AT&T came out with this silly little device they call a transistor during that time. And let's see, the substrates and so on and so forth that contain these things had these little black objects on it that nobody knew what they were. But in 1958, Texas Instruments came out with this first integrated circuit. Battelle, then exploring this material, came out with memory metal that is actually, will you can puncture it and it will come back to its original shape again. All right. Now, what else was on? Uncovered. Stealth technology was uncovered from this. Laser technology was uncovered from this crash. So these are the things that we're enjoying today that were essentially gathered from the artifacts that were recovered. But of course, then nobody will ever admit to it and protected it.
I'm going to ask about the Roswell crash. There's this thing I've thought about before is that one of our craft crashed, we'd send out emergency services to try and help the crew, and we'd also try and recover the craft. But the ETs just didn't seem to do that with Roswell. Maybe they crashed on purpose, maybe to cede technology to the humans?
I think that the part of that crash, it's alleged that there was like a major thunderstorm through the area, and that could have created some issues which then precipitated the crash. Now, it's also alleged that there were three craft that went down, okay? But the one that everyone seems to be most familiar with is that one that everyone is speaking about. The other two don't get as much visibility. But I don't think that it was purposeful. I think that they did run into some issues with the thunderstorm that then caused the aircraft to come down. And it's a good thought to think about, though, you know, whether or not they they wanted to perhaps interject some technology and see where we go from that, you know? If you think about the transistor, now prior to the transistor, the technology was for calculations and computers, essentially was electromechanical relays and stepper switches and so on and so forth, which is very cumbersome and very requiring large areas for this equipment to reside in. So now the transistor comes out, and part of it was to replace a technology that was introduced to help with the electromechanical switches and relays, and those were vacuum tubes. And I don't know if some of your listeners are familiar with vacuum tubes. These are the old days where you turned on a radio and you had to wait for the tube to heat up before you heard anything, or with the TV. Because vacuum tubes use this technology called thermionic emission, which heated up a filament to boil off the electrons that then were amplified and created the signal that you hear and watch. But now the transistor comes along and it reduces the size of things and also the speeds of things. And the transistor has gone through a whole... It's unbelievable how quickly the technology has jumped ahead. If you think about those olden days of the computers, like the UNIVAC and ENIAC computer, there's a that can do several, you know, maybe 10,000 operations or so a second. There's computers now that are over at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which are called the Frontier, and I don't know if anybody is familiar with the mathematical jargon, like the powers of 10, like 100 is 1 times 10 to the 2, okay? 1,000 is 1 times 10 to the 3. Well, these computers that are in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, can do 1 times 10 to the 18th operations per second. That's a billion operations a second. I can't imagine anything that fast running with electronic relays or electromechanical relays and stepper switches. And today, based on the advances in the technology, we have more power in our cell phones than they had on the first Apollo mission. So that's where we're moving in leaps and bounds. And I'm wondering whether or not they're visiting us now just to see and check to see where we are now. I guess they're getting more and more concerned about nuclear, all right? That seems to get their attention quite a bit. And a lot of the nuclear facilities and the nuclear power stations there are reports of these objects buzzing them. I wrote a chapter in the book called 1965. The year is 1965. And several things happened during that time where, first off, was the New York City blackout, okay? And I don't know if that made news over at the UK, but it was big news here. And then there was the sightings in a small town up in New Hampshire called Exeter, where the police were involved and a number of citizens were involved of UFO sightings there. And then finally, there was Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. I don't know if your audience has heard of Kecksburg, where an object was tracked over 5 states and then crashed in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, and was recovered and taken out to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which seems to be an area where a lot of UFO crash recoveries and artifacts and such are stored at Wright-Patt. So... interesting stuff there. And I go into a little bit of detail about that year in 65, where they say, oh, it was a bad relay or something up in Canada is what caused it. And it was like a domino effect that went down and caused all the other stations to come down. But prior to that event, there was a lot of UFO activity spotted up around those power plants, which was never reported. And you mean to tell me that a UFO that can disable a missile battery and disable all the missiles within that battery. Can't go in and mess up a relay. Come on now, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Major Filer, because he's kind of co-author. He had an amazing sighting of his own when he was flying. But could you tell us, who is Major Filer?
Major Filer is a good friend of mine. He is, at the time, incident that occurred, he was in intelligence, okay, at McGuire Air Force Base. Now, there are several bases in New Jersey. Lakehurst is a naval base. Fort Dix is a military army base. And then right next door to Fort Dix is McGuire Air Force Base. And the two bases are separated with a chain link fence. So Major Filer was, he was in charge of intelligence and at the base. And there was an incident which occurred over in Fort Dix, where there's a number of reports of UFOs buzzing the base or flying above the base. And of course, you know, this was kept hush hush. A lot of people didn't know about it and so on. But one day, I guess, because of it, they were somewhat on alert that these objects are flying above the bases. And on one particular day, back in 1978, I guess there were a couple of MPs were on patrol at the base, and they noticed craft in the area, and they noticed some creature ran in front of their Jeep, and they stopped the Jeep, and they told this thing to stop, you know, hold, and it didn't. And I guess because of the excitement, maybe he was scared or whatever, he unloaded his 45 into this creature. And the creature then took off and ran, and he ran over to McGuire Air Force Base and essentially passed away at McGuire. So there was a lot of activity going on. So Major Filer was coming into the base that day, and he noticed down on one of the runways there were a lot of blue lights and such going on out there. He didn't know what the devil was going on. He tried to get a handle on it because his job, he had to report to the general there to tell him what was going on the day before and so on. And him asking around, a lot of people didn't know anything other than the fact that somebody kept telling them that there was an alien shot and killed on at. Apparently, in the New Jersey State Police was involved in this as well, because there was an incident called Shots Fired, okay? So they came, and they wouldn't let him on the base right away. But getting back to Major Filer, this wasn't his first experience with UFOs. He was, I guess, during around in the 60s, he was part of an air refueling squadron that was based over at Sculthorpe RAF base in the UK. He was part of the 420th Air Force. And their mission was to, again, refuel the aircraft that was in the area. And then one day while they're working out there, they received information coming in from London Control that there was an unknown object floating around in the area, and they wanted to know whether or not that they could investigate it. So George indicated that their mission was pretty much over so that they could do that. So they accepted that request and went toward the location where this object was being tracked by London Control. In fact, London Control gave them permission to go into that airspace. I guess they call it a Queen's clearance or something. I don't know what that is.
I think that's when they clear the airspace, that they tell all the aircraft to go into different directions. So there's a big empty space in the sky that they can fly through.
Gives them a free lane to go in.
Yeah.
Well, they went in and they tracked this thing down, and it was a very big target on their radar. In fact, George indicated that in his travels out there in Scotland, there's a bridge. It's called the Firth of Forth Bridge. And he says that target or that bridge represented a footprint on his radar that was about the size of this object that they were looking at. And as they got closer and closer and closer, this thing just took off like a bat out of hell and went straight up, and they lost it, okay? Now, it got a lot of people's attention, and I guess at some point during that weekend, Prince Philip wanted to meet with some of the officers from that mission and stuff, and they got to talking a little bit about UFOs and so on and so forth. And the prince indicated that he had an interest in it as well, I guess, based on stories that he had heard from his uncle, which is Lord Mountbatten. And I guess Lord Mountbatten talked to him about some objects that he had hovering over his estate back in, I guess, in 1955. And they were credible. Because one of his, I guess, caretakers, a fellow by the name of Biggs, Mr. Biggs, was the person that saw it. And this whole thing was published in one of your papers. I guess it's called The Sun.
Yeah.
And I guess it's owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. I'm not certain. But it's like a tabloid or something, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it spoke about that thing back then. I believe it was published in that paper in the year 2017, around September timeframe or something. So he talked about he saw this. His caretaker saw this silver spaceship landing on the estate, and then he saw some individual coming out of the thing. Okay, and he was quite concerned. And he says while looking at it, he said he was on a bicycle. I guess this Fred Biggs was either a caretaker or he maintained property as a bricklayer or something over there. He saw this thing and he wanted to get out of there, but he got knocked off of his bicycle that he was traveling on, and he couldn't get off the ground. He tried to get up and he couldn't get up, and so he told that story. And I guess then Lord Montauban went out onto the property and he saw the area of the footprints and so on and so forth. And so it gives credibility that this thing actually did land. And so he shared that story, I guess, with Prince Philip. And Prince Philip actually indicated that when he was over in the Mediterranean, that during later years, that his ships were being buzzed by aircraft out there, unknown aircraft. So I guess the royals wanted to keep some of this stuff under wraps. They don't like to talk about this that much. Is that pretty much the way it is now out there, Simon?
Yeah, I would think so. The way the newspapers and the media follow them, every tiny little detail. And I suppose with the stigma of UFOs, they wouldn't really want that out.
Yeah, well, you have an individual there that's quite verbal about it. It's Nick Pope. And I met him several times. In fact, I just met him this past weekend. MUFON had a conference here in Philadelphia. And he was there speaking, and there were other ufologists that were there speaking, which then attracted a large audience into a conference hall where they were speaking about various topics and so on. So Nick and I, this isn't the first time that I've met him. And so he's very verbal. I mean, he's been on television and so on and so forth, because I guess he was part of the Ministry of Defense out there.
Yeah, I think he was a civilian contractor, wasn't he?
Not certain. Other than he said he was part of the MOD. That's as far as what he had said. Now, one of the things that is interesting is that the UK tends to want to open, lack of a better expression, open up their kimono and spill out all the information they have on UFOs to the public. But yet the U.S. is keeping that stuff very, very tight and close to the vest. They don't want to admit it. And it just drives me crazy because people are seeing this stuff. All these thousands of people are seeing this, and we're not crazy. We're seeing this stuff. And again, that's another reason why I wanted to write this book. But getting back to George Filer, eventually he found that there was a creature that was shot, and he died at McGuire. There was a C-141 that was flown in, I believe, the same day from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. There was a group of people that came out with uniforms that did not have insignia on them, because there were several MPs that were over at McGuire that were guarding the body. And they said the thing smelled like high concentrations of ammonia. And so these individuals came out, and eventually they let the state police in too. And this was at Gate 5 at McGuire. And the state police was there. And so then this group came in with, I guess, coveralls or whatever. And they had a wooden casket or coffin, and they picked the body up and put it in this wooden coffin, sprayed it down or covered it with some material, and then put it on a Jeep and went out to the runway. They then put it on into another metal container, put it onto the plane, and took off. And they went out to Wright-Patt Air Force Base. There were some individuals that came up from Washington, D.C., and the people that were there that witnessed this stuff, George trying to find out what was going on. There were pictures taken and so on. And he said they actually had the pictures. And he says, well, let me see the pictures so he can debrief the general when he comes in because of all the activity that's going on in the base. And they wouldn't let him see the pictures. And he was intelligence, which was frustrating, of actual photographs. So again, this made the papers and so on and so forth, and it was covered up. Now, the people that were there that witnessed this thing soon after were transferred to bases like in Japan and Far East, so you couldn't get access to them. But then as the story went on, there were more and more researchers that came in, and they found more and more activity going on. But again, that one is still open for all intents and purposes. And to this day, it's still open. And that's what precipitated me getting interested in it. I wasn't involved in that investigation, but it's been out there like folklore, okay? Like, what happened over there? So that's when I sat down, contacted George, and met with him at his home, and met with him and his lovely wife. And we spent some time together, and he provided the information then and contributed to that one chapter in the book that speaks about that whole situation.
Yeah, it looks like you really did a great investigation there. You had lots of people trying to track down witnesses, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, as did he. Okay, and he still stays in touch with some of these people, but they don't want to talk about it.
Was there a guy called Carlos Cruz who had some kind of experience?
Yeah, he was on the base. Okay, I believe he was one of the sergeants, and I believe that he got transferred out, and he was afraid to come forward for fear of retribution against him.
But there was what was it? He saw a UFO, and there was some missing time for him, almost like a abduction.
Yes, and he thought he saw. Well, again, with this one, I guess they came back down looking for this individual that was shot and killed. They came back down, and what he remembers is that it wasn't a humanoid. It was almost like a robotic type creature that was looking for him, looking their associate, and that's what he remembers from what I can recall. Okay, this is going back some now, but yeah, he had like a lost time experience as well. And that seems to be quite prevalent where people that either are abducted or such cannot recall periods of time. Like I indicated, one of my investigations that I did prior to me writing this book was of a possible abduction that occurred at Washington Crossing State Park in Pennsylvania, of a young woman that I believe was abducted. I have her on tape, and I really believe she was abducted based on what everything that she told me. And she has no memory of it. And I wanted to put her together with a Professor David Jacobs, who was a professor at the University of Penn, who was involved in regression hypnosis sessions. And I wanted her and him to get together to try and recall her experiences. And she didn't want any part of it. She didn't want to know what happened.
I was interested to read in the book that, like, you know, they shot this alien and maybe killed it, probably killed it, but that wasn't a crime. It's like the law says you kill a human, it's a crime. But so they didn't have to report the killing of an alien to the police because it's not illegal.
Right. Well, but the police did respond because of the shots fired. And the funny thing is trying to contact, in doing the research to this base for this chapter myself, I tried contacting the New Jersey State Police that responded to this incident, and that barracks has been closed. To try to get to the people that were there, that you can't get to them because they're no longer there.
Have you had your own sightings?
I had a sighting of an anomaly, which I guess way before I joined MUFON, I came on board with MUFON back in 1995, and then, you know, purchased their manual, studied the manual, was tested, passed the test, and then went through all of the ranks as a field investigator in training, so on and so forth, all the way up to where I left MUFON as a state director. But one time it was in the evening where it was bedtime, and laying in bed with my wife, I was facing her and she was facing our windows, and we were talking, and she said, "My God, what was that?" And I said, "What?" And she says, "Both windows filled up with green light." I said, "Really?" But the light didn't come into the room. It was like there was a giant green light outside the windows, but no light entered the room. So I got up out of bed and I went out to the window and looked, and the light went off, but then it came back on again. And what it looked like to me, the whole sky lit up, and what it looked like was, have you ever noticed what headlights look like in fog? I guess you're familiar with fog out there in the UK.
Yeah.
How the light is dispersed over a larger area than the actual light itself. I had seen a green situation like that, to the western part of the horizon, and I just stood there looking at it, and it was moving across the horizon, going in an easterly direction. So it crossed the horizon from the west to the east, and I'd say in a period of maybe about 2 minutes, and then it went away. And I said, I didn't know what it was. And I didn't think it was a meteor or a bolide because that was too slow. Okay. It was much too slow. and also for a satellite, because satellites move pretty quick, but I don't know why it would illuminate the sky that much, that the whole sky was illuminated. So, I thought about it. And then the next day I started digging around and looking, and I came up with some news that I heard that people in Philadelphia, which is probably as the crow flies, if you would, maybe 45 minutes from where I am, had a similar sighting of the sky lining up where they are. But that was the only experience that I've had. Now, I've talked to people that, you know, like I said, was possibly abducted. So I can say with authority that if, you know, people say, "Well, if I see a UFO, I'm going to go outside and look at it." And I say, "What would you do?" I says, "I would get the heck out of there." Okay. I wouldn't stick around, you know.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book is called UFOs, sightings, reports, and cover-ups. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, they can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's a another platform. They're based down in Australia. It's called books.by. And my book is there. It's available. And if people, you know, take the time and read it, a lot of the stuff in there is not, imagine if you would, that, you know, we have this technology because of ancient aliens and stuff. A lot of the programs that you're seeing on TV, I believe, I view them as entertainment only, because everything you see is, you know, not necessarily attributed to ancient aliens, even though they're trying to say that. But just understand that I believe that there are species here. I believe there's six of them here. And we're working with multiple governments. And it's exciting to see where we're going next. I mean, we were, you know, even people are saying that the landing on the moon was fake. But then I had also heard that we were told, don't come back here anymore. All right. So I don't know, you know, I'm keeping an open mind. That's what I'm saying. I'm keeping an open mind. And I look at it this way, and this is the only way I can ever deal with this, Simon, is on a clear night, I go outside. And clear nights are difficult here in the greater Philadelphia area because of light pollution and such. And you look up at the sky, and if there's no clouds and stuff, you see all of these stars out there. It's incredible the amount of stars you see. And that's just a small, very small portion of a galaxy that we're in called the Milky Way. And the Milky Way has billions and billions and billions of stars. So we're only seeing a small sampling of them. But the small sampling that we see is unbelievable. It fills up our sky. Now, if you were to go back and imagine, if you would, that you can just pick yourself up off of this planet and put yourself out in space looking back at our planet, okay? Now, our planet and a bunch of other rocks are floating around this thing that we call the sun. The sun is a star, okay? Just like all the other ones that are in the sky, all right? Except our star that we know has a bunch of rocks floating around, and we're on one of them, and we call it Earth. And we're intelligent species on Earth. And you mean to tell me you look at all those stars up in that small section of sky that we see that's made up of the galaxy, that's made up of thousands of galaxies in the universe, and we're the only intelligent life out there?
Yeah, it's like that thing. There's so many billions of stars in our galaxy. And if we were the only civilization in this galaxy, there's still trillions of other galaxies. And if there was only one civilization in each of those, that would still mean there's trillions of civilizations.
That's correct. I can't think that way. I think that we're not alone. We are not alone. And it makes you think sometimes too. I guess another thought is that we're an experiment. Okay, the Earth was visited many, many millennia ago, and perhaps for. Again, this is another one of the theories that are floating around to get materials like gold and such for maybe requirements on other planets or civilizations that they required gold. So they came here to do the mining, and they found these creatures running around, apes and stuff, and they figured, well, let's take a look at this, and maybe we can... play around a little bit so that we don't have to go out and do our mining. Maybe we can create these beings to go out and do our mining for us. So to that end, they mix some of their DNA with the DNA of the creatures that they found here and created a group of individuals that then could be trained to do the mining for them. And then over the millennium, this group of individuals evolved and evolved and evolved to perhaps us.
Yeah, it's quite a thought. Well, we've just about run out of time. So thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and I hope your audience enjoys this. And really, take a look at the book. There was a lot of work that went into it. It took me over a year plus to write that book. But everything that's in there is factual. It's been documented. I have proof. It's in the book. And again, Simon, thank you. And thank you, audience, for giving me this opportunity to speak today.
Thanks a lot. That was an interview with Bill Weber about his book, UFO Sightings, Reports and Cover-Ups. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.